Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the prosecution is not going to get that man today. No, because I'm going to get him.
Hagman and Hagman Report. That's right. The Hagman and Hagman Report. We're coming to you live from our radio and television studios here in just beautifully dreary northwest Pennsylvania today. Again, live from our radio and television studios. I want to thank each and every one of you for joining us tonight, joining me tonight. Joe is not in tonight. Not that I gave him the day off. Apparently he must have. Well, he took a tumble and maybe broke his ankle. So it's going to be me flying solo, but not really solo. We have a very special guest tonight, Jim Mars. I'll tell you something. I just can't wait to get into the conversation with Jim Mars tonight. So, folks, saddle for battle. The hour is late. Time is short. We're being gamed every step of the way. It seems like every day there's a different headline with a different spin, with a different take, with a different crisis, with a different plan. The past is indeed prologue. Oh man, I'll tell you something, folks. It is getting to the point now where you just don't know what will happen next. As I mentioned, Jim Mars is coming up today. Doug flying solo, Doug Hagman flying solo on the Hagman and Hagman Report. HagmanReport.com. That's for news, information, analysis. HagmanandHagman.com. That's our show page. Of course, we broadcast right here on the Global Star Radio Network. We're simulcast on Blog Talk Radio. I want to thank them both, BTR as well as Global Star. Global Star is the place to be, folks. It's a great network. Thanks so much, Todd, for carrying our program. And being the great guy you are, we should all give him a round of applause to the studio audience. And, of course, you can watch us live right here on our official YouTube channel, Team K9. Folks, if you haven't done so, subscribe to our YouTube channel as well as our social networking feed. Tonight's broadcast brought to you, folks, courtesy of Minuteman Stove. It's right down there in the show description. MinutemanStove.com. That's MinutemanStove.com. Folks, if you, right now, in these uncertain times, oh boy, are they uncertain, it just makes sense to have a sustainable backup method for accomplishing one of life's most basic, most important daily task, and that's preparing food. You know, I made the mistake of not preparing, not really realizing, you know, what we needed to cook food. I mean, really. And it was one day when my wife said to me, and I'm very serious about this, who's cooking, you or me? And with what? In the event of an emergency. And it was right around the same time that I was introduced to Lane Miller from Minuteman Stove. So, folks, MinutemanStove.com, MinutemanStove.com. Need I say more? More later, but you get the idea. You don't want to be eating freeze-dried chicken. It's not bad when you do the fruit, but I've got to tell you, the meat is best served warm. I was in a restaurant the other day, and I ordered chicken, and I asked for it medium. Pink inside. Just kidding, of course. You had to be there, I guess. That just felt like a lead balloon, right? Single acts of tyranny may be ascribed to the accidental opinion of the day, but a series of oppressions begun at a distinguished period and pursued unalterably through every change of through every change of ministers too plainly proves a deliberate, systemic plan of reducing us to slavery. It's Thomas Jefferson, and that's Thomas Jefferson as cited by our guest tonight, Jim Mars. Jim Mars's book, Our Occulted History. That's right, Our Occulted History by Jim Mars. Do the global elite conceal ancient aliens? Or more, would I like to ask, do they conceal a hidden agenda? And I think that they do. And of course, Jim Mars has got a number of other books, including, and we've got them all, I think every one of them. Rule by Secrecy, Jim Mars, and The Rise of the Fourth Reich. I don't have enough hands for the books he's written. This book is incredible, Rise of the Fourth Reich. This fits so well with what Steve Quayle has written. Just amazing. And what Peter LaVenda has written and others. But Jim Mars nails it. And I've got the trillion-dollar conspiracy in my office, and I spoke at length to Jim Mars today about tonight, what we're going to talk about tonight. And I got a feeling we're going to cover a lot of ground. So from our occulted history to a number of other issues. So are you ready? Are you buckled in? Are you ready? Are you saddled for battle? I hope you are. Without any further ado, folks, his website is jimmars.com. Two R's. That's jimmars.com. Visit his website. Bookmark his website. And on the program description, if you look, it's a link to his Amazon page where all of his books are. I'm gonna tell you what an incredible array of books he's written, more than I could than I could ever think of writing. And I just finished, as of this morning, Our Occulted History. So if we have him ready, is he on? Ready to go? Let's rock and roll. Jim, how are you, sir?
Doug, it's great to be with you. I'm sorry Joe is absentee, and I just be sure and send my best wishes and prayers along, because I hate to see anybody get hurt. I know my wife fell down the other day and came home feeling pretty miserable, but then she managed to get a good night's sleep, and she got up and kept going. She said now she's glad she's got that extra weight. It gave her some cushion.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny, Jim. I often refer to Hillary because she is going to be propped up by pillows. I say, you know, weebles wobble, but they don't fall down. Well, Joe, you know, I think maybe this might have been some bad backsplash there, because Joe did fall down. But yeah, you know, it's he hurt his paw, and double entendre there. But anyway, he'll be back with us, I'm sure, on Monday. But Jim, it's great have you. Man, I'll tell you something. You have really nailed it with your books, all of your books. If we can do something, because I thought this was great. After we hung up today on the phone, after we got done talking, I was just really kind of blown away. I don't know. Can you share the story about the title of Trillion-Dollar Conspiracy? Is that okay to share that? Because I thought that was
Well, you know, hey, they can censor my books, but they can't censor my mouth, okay?
Well, you know...
What I was telling Doug today is, because he was giving me some very nice compliments about my book, The Trillion-Dollar Conspiracy, which was kind of covers what's happened between 2008 and now with the financial frauds and the near collapse of the financial system, and of course world.com and Enron and all these things that we tend to forget about, you know, that at one point were major financial poles, supports for our financial system, and then they all crumble away. But I told him, I said, the publishers made me change the title. And I said, I don't want to change the title. And they said, no, we won't publish it unless you change the title to The Trillion-Dollar Conspiracy. I said, oh, man. because my original title had been Zombie Nation. Okay? Now, that would attract some attention, wouldn't it? And this, by the way, folks, was this was, you know, I don't know, I'd have to look and see exactly when that came out, but here I can find here real quick. That was like 2000 and, this was 2010, okay? This was before The Walking Dead. This was before all the zombie movies. This was before the zombie genre got to be such a fad among, you know, young people and everybody. And the only excuse they ever gave me for changing the title from Zombie Nation was that they were afraid people might buy it thinking they were getting a zombie novel, okay? And as I explained to them, I said, well, number one, if they can't read the book cover and if they can't thumb through it and realize this is a nonfiction book, then they probably deserve to buy it, you know. And on top of that, from a mercenary standpoint, what's the problem? You're talking about increased sales. So obviously there was something other. That was just a cover. The other thing, and I think this is important, is that my editor, the person I was actually dealing with, he actually told me, he said, this was not my idea. He said, this came down from upstairs. Okay, so somebody upstairs, somebody I don't know who, I have no contact with, I cannot plead my case to, is making decisions on, you know, what the book cover is going to be. And let me explain why I wanted to use the title Zombie Nation. Because at that time, and to a certain extent today, everybody, I'm sure you all remember that after the 2008 financial slump, we had these banks that were by the books insolvent. They were broke. But they got propped up by that public tax money, TARP, and the TARP money went to them, and they were still operating. So they're broke, they're dead, but they're still operating. And that's why the financial people then termed them zombie banks. And I'm sure most of you, if you'll think back, you'll remember hearing that term. So I decided when I was writing my book, I took a look at the numbers. This nation today is in debt to the tune of more than $20 trillion, okay, which is an unimaginable number. And yet I also saw that if everyone in this country, and I mean everyone, I'm talking about every man, woman, and child, if we all sold off all our assets, our homes, our cars, our TVs, our clothes, we probably could not accumulate much more than about $10 trillion, which means we're still $10 trillion short of the $20 trillion we owe, which means financially we're dead. But we're still operating. We all get up and go to work. We still get that paycheck. The computer blips representing our money is still there. So we are a zombie nation. And I thought it was quite apropos to use as a title, but see, somewhere somebody said that might draw too much attention. That might be too simple. People might understand that. We may get too many people reading about that. So they forced me to change the title. It became The $1 trillion Conspiracy. It was, and I have checked, mostly it was stuck on the financial shelf of the bookstores, which no one except just that small niche of people who, care about investments and stocks and bonds. They're the only ones that goes and looks at the financial shelf. And although it did very well, it was not included among my New York Times bestsellers.
You know, you talk about the ultimate censorship and the irony of things. Yeah. Wow. Wow.
Well, and let me explain one step further, Doug, because I don't want people to think that I'm just, this is just sour grapes. You know, I don't care. I'm not writing for the money. I'm writing to tell people information, because this goes all the way back to my degree in journalism. I committed to be a journalist, and I was taught back in the days of the old Republic that I was supposed to be finding out the truth as best I could and then presenting that to the public. And fool that I was, I really thought that's what I was supposed to be doing, and I still do. So that's what I'm trying to do, is simply, I'm not trying to sell books, I'm trying to get information out to people. Unfortunately, most of the major media today, certainly the major broadcast media and most of the major newspapers, they have all fallen under the control of a handful, a literal handful, about five corporations with interlocking ownerships and directorships. So we have a small clique of people who now control everything we see and hear, okay, with the only exception now of social media, which is that, and they're trying to curtail that, and some of the alternative broadcast media such as Hagman and Hagman and others I could name. But if you don't tune in and listen to these specific places, if you just watch TV, you are getting the corporate party line with all the twist spins and misinformation and disinformation. It's really incredible. And also in that same book, Zombie Nation, I had a whole section. I'm mentioning this because I think this will prove to any thinking person that this is nothing but sheer censorship. My editor says, I think you need to leave this section out. And I said, well, I don't think so. I think it's very important, and I think people need to know about this. And he said, well, let me put it this way. If you don't take this out, I'm going to cancel the book. So in other words, you do it our way or it doesn't get published. Well, of course, that leaves me in a position of, well, I either have to agree to take it out or none of it gets out. So I caved and I said, okay, we'll take it out. And what was the section that they wanted me to take out? The section about how the corporations censor the news. And I couldn't help but laugh. I told him, I said, well, you've kind of proved my point, haven't you? Is that incredible?
It is. And ladies and gentlemen, we're talking with Jim Mars. Jim Mars, that's jimmars.com. You know, Jim, when you told me that, it really kind of smacked me upside the head thinking about that. The irony, and of course, yes, I mean, the censorship, the different methods that they tweak and they censor us. Oh,
right.
But man, you know, it's yeah.
Well, look at a very, very recent example that I think of is that when the national media shows the Donald Trump talks at the Republican National Convention, they mostly zoomed in on him. You get to see him, and yeah, there's a bunch of people behind him, but it's just him, and there's people behind him. You don't rarely showed you the overall picture, okay? Then same thing on the Democratic National Convention. When Hillary's up speaking, they kind of zoom in on her, and then they'll pan out maybe just a little bit, and it looks like she's right there before a huge crowd. In fact, but then when you actually see the actual photographs, you'll find that in Donald Trump, if you could see the total picture of the auditorium, the arena where he is, it's packed. It's shoulder to shoulder. There are thousands of people there. On Hillary, and I have seen the photographs, if you back off, there's a lot of empty seats. And in fact, and I checked on this, it's absolutely true. There was an advertisement on Craigslist. They actually advertised and paid people $50 to come and fill seats at the Democratic National Convention, because after the pro-Bernie Sanders people walked out, that place was probably about half empty. there was no massive support for Hillary Clinton. And yet you wouldn't know that by watching the news, because they just zoom in on the candidates and flash around and show you pictures of where there are some filled seats, and you think there's a massive crowd there when there's not.
Amazing. Yeah, I saw that. I saw the report of that about the Craigslist, and I really, at first, I thought it was a spoof. I thought,
I did too. Yeah.
Man. And to think of it, yes.
Until I saw, and I think it was my friend Alex Jones, who one of his reporters actually grabbed one of these guys and did an interview with him. And I saw the interview, and he's kind of shuffling his feet. And he was a clean cut young white guy with a dark suit and a tie. And he says, Yeah, I was paid $50 to come sit here in the seat.
Yeah, exactly. And Jim, I was on with Alex Jones this past Tuesday, and I asked him about that just to make sure. I think it was Joe Biggs that was there at the convention. I can't remember, but yeah, he said, "Oh yeah, that was true." You know,
yeah.
It's amazing.
As a newsman of almost 50 years, half a century, I've been in the news business. Okay. To me, that's news. That should have been news that the Democratic National Party are having to pay people to come fill the seats. Okay? That should have been a news story. But
Amen.
You never saw that anywhere except Alex Jones, and now we're mentioning it.
Yeah, exactly. And folks, I mean, pay attention, because what Jim Mars is talking about here is so important, because we're being gamed. This whole thing is a massaging of our perception, and perception is reality, as you well know, right? I mean, this is how everything's, you know, being gamed. Well, Jim, you have I took out all of your books from my bookcase, and I put them on our conference table today, and I was going kind of through each one of them. You've woven a tapestry, just a marvelous, exquisite tapestry. If you did not write another word, the tapestry that you've written, or that you've created through your writings, takes us from the most, I don't know, the deepest of the earliest of times to the current events. I mean,
takes us from the ridiculous to the sublime.
That too.
All right, Doug, here's this is interesting. Think about this, Doug. Not too long back, I was on somebody's talk show, and actually this was early on, because now I have about, I don't know, 8 or 10 books, but they were talking about my trilogy. And I thought, what are they talking about? I hadn't written a trilogy. But when I went back and really got to thinking about it, there is some truth there. The first book that I wrote that immediately hit the New York Times bestseller list was Crossfire, The Plot to Kill Kennedy. And that came out in the late 80s, okay? And that was simply a book about all the information I'd gathered on the Kennedy assassination. And I had all this because I was here. I have a photograph of me as a young, wild college kid dancing on the stage of Jack Ruby's Carousel Club that was taken about a month before the Kennedy assassination. So I was here. So I was here the whole time.
Okay,
I lived
wait,
through
whoa.
It.
Where were you? And where were you at 12:30 on November 22nd? You were okay.
I hate to admit it. I was in bed asleep. Okay. But to give you some idea, to show you that that my book about Kennedy was not out of some fad or some love of Kennedy. I was in college. I was on a degree for journalism. I had to have a lot of English, of course, and I'd had an English exam that morning, that Friday morning, and as was kind of my wont, I had kind of stayed up all night cramming, okay, for this test. And I went, took the test, got back to my apartment about 11 o'clock or maybe a little after in the morning, and needless to say, I was dead tired. So I went in and flopped on my bed, and I was asleep at 12:30 when the assassination happened. My roommate ran in and said, "Wake up!" said, "They shot Kennedy." And I was half asleep. And also, again, keep in mind, I was redneck Texan. I was had grown up in the Baptist church from the pulpit. I'd been told that if Kennedy gets elected, the Pope will run the country, and that he was soft on communism. And although I thought he was a good-looking guy, had a beautiful wife, and I thought it was kind of cool that we would have a president with some little kids crawling around in the Oval Office, I was not a Kennedy supporter. So my roommate said, no, seriously, something's happened. So I went, what? Okay, now I'm awake. Now I'm a journalism major. Now I know that I better start paying attention. So we ran in, turned on this little funky television set we had, and black and white, of course. And I remember we were watching TV for maybe 15, 20 minutes before Walter Cronkite finally came on, and wiping tears from his eyes, and said, it's now official, the president is dead. Well, they made that announcement right around 1 o'clock that afternoon, which means I was on to this story within 10 minutes of it happening, okay? And like I said, I'd already been in Dallas. I knew who ran Dallas. I knew the conservative streak of Dallas. And I knew that H.L. Hunt had posted those wanted posters for Kennedy.
Hey, Jim. Hold on to that thought. We're up against the break. This is okay. Fascinating, though. Folks, you're listening to Jim Mars. What a treat. What a treat to have Jim Mars. I want to give a shout out to John Robertson for assisting in setting this interview up. God bless John. But Jim Mars, author of Our Occulted History and many other books, folks, visit jimmars.com. Truly a great truth teller and a patriot, and now obviously a friend of this program. Wow. jimmars.com. We're going to be right back. Stay right where you're at, folks. Jim Mars is our guest for the entire program. I just pinch me. Oh, man. A gentleman that I have grown, I just have a tremendous amount of respect for. I've read almost all of his books, I think. Although I've got to get that. I got to get Crossfire. I've got to get that. So maybe I can... maybe I can twist Jim's arm a little bit if he's got an extra copy in his office. What a great patriot! What a man of I'll tell you something. He's probably forgotten more about our occulted history, the nation's history, than I will ever know. A journalist, author, researcher, New York Times bestseller of many books, Our Occulted History. That's the big one right now, folks. Go to Amazon, grab that book while you can, before you know what hits the fan. Before we get back to Jim, I just want to mention as well, I want to give our best out to Pastor Paul Begley. Yeah, it's my understanding he was in a motor vehicle accident and he was briefly hospitalized, although he's okay. Thankfully. He's okay, but want to give our best wishes out to Pastor Paul Begley for his speedy recovery from whatever residual effects from the motor vehicle accident. Of course, Pastor Paul Begley, a friend of the program as well, and he's got a great program every day. I haven't had an opportunity to reach out to him, but I will. And, of course, I'm flying solo tonight, Joe. My son, co-host, is... he's a gimp. He's walking around. Well, he's not walking around, apparently. He's we're waiting on the x-rays to determine whether indeed his ankle is fractured. But apparently his ankle was the size of a pumpkin. And we're waiting on the crime scene analysis to determine whether or not he indeed tripped or where his wife might have been. That's right. Now, our guest tonight, again, is Jim Mars. Visit his website. That's jimmars2rs.com. All of the links are on the show description there on YouTube, BTR, and Global Star Radio Network as well, and Hagman and Hagman.com, HagmanReport.com. That said, Jim Mars being in Dallas, dancing on the stage of the Carousel Club, Jack Ruby's Carousel Club, a month before the assassination, awakened by his roommate of the news of the Kennedy assassination. Jim, that kind of, did that start you out in your just infamous quest for the truth, or is that what really got you? I mean,
well, no, actually, it goes back further than that. I can remember even in junior high school, I was drawing little cartoons, I was writing little stories, and then I got to high school, and I ended up being a page editor on the high school paper, and I would draw cartoons, and I would take pictures, and I would, and I've done that. And then when I went to college, while I was going to college as a underclassman, I was working for the Denton Record Chronicle, covering sports and drawing cartoons and taking photographs. And then I became editorial page editor of the campus newspaper. That's what I was doing at the time of the Kennedy assassination. So yeah, I was already on a road to journalism. I tell you, if you want to know, here's my dirty little secret. I had already had such experience there. In fact, also in high school, I worked on the Junior Achievement Program, where me and several other high school kids were accepted to write and publish and edit an entire page for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, which was a major big city newspaper, and I forget if they had a title for it, but basically it was a teen page, okay? So we were writing stories, composing headlines, and that put me in touch, and we would do that at the newspaper. So that put me into contact, even in early high school, with senior editors, reporters, people who later would cover the Kennedy assassination. So, see, I've kind of been involved in it all along, but the dirty secret is that I, even at that point, I had not really decided that that was going to be my life's work. It was when I got to college and they asked me what my degree plan was going to be. And I'm going to confess that I was really bad in math. And I think the reason for that, Doug, is because to me, I cannot relate math to people, and I'm kind of a people person. I like talking to people. I like hearing their stories. I like trying to see how things affect people. And when it came to math, and particularly algebra, A plus B equals C, and it's like, what? What are you talking about? You know? So
I hear you. Yeah.
So when I got to college, I said, well, what degree plan do you have that does not require any math? And they said, well, there's journalism. And I said, okay, sign me up. So that's when I officially got in journalism. But as you can see, I was there even beforehand. So when the Kennedy assassination happened, I mean, you know, I knew. I said, this is a big story. And it happened right here in my backyard. Happened right there in Dallas. I know people in Dallas. I know how Dallas is run. I know who runs Dallas. And so I began to pay very, very close attention and started working on that case just, like I said, 10 to 15 minutes after it had happened. Now, the thing that got me going was that whole weekend, and I don't know, you may not remember this, Doug, but that whole weekend, all the media was preempted. If you turn on the TV, if you turn on the radio, if you picked up a newspaper, you're going to read about the Kennedy assassination because that's all they were talking about. Okay?
That's right.
Unlike today, I know on 9/11, if you went to the major news channels or the major networks, they're all talking about 9/11, but you could always turn over to the Disney Channel, right? Or the Cartoon Channel or the Sci-Fi Channel, and you didn't have to watch about 9/11 if you didn't want to. But in 1963, that weekend, if you turn on a radio, TV, or read a newspaper, it was the Kennedy assassination. So we were all paying attention. And the thing that struck me right off was that weekend was the number of witnesses in Davy Plaza who said that The numbers varied. Some people said there were as many as 6-8 shots, maybe more. Others said there were 2-3 shots, and it kind of varied. But the consensus seemed to be that there was a shot and then a pause and then 2 shots, pow, pow, right on top of each other. And this is pretty much what has been established to this very day. Okay, now at that time I was in Texas, and I had bolt-action rifles. I'd been deer hunting. And I knew that you can't get a bang-bang with a bolt-action rifle. You have to cock the bolt, eject the empty shell, load the new shell, push the bolt down before you can pull the trigger. So the best you can get with a bolt-action rifle would have been a pow, pow, pow. And when they said there was a pow, pow, then that immediately kind of raised the red flag for me. And in fact, in later years, I interviewed a friend of mine, Jim Wright, who was the former Speaker of the House. And he had been riding in the motorcade right behind Kennedy. And he told me the same thing. And he was a hunter. He knew guns. He said there was a shot and a pause, and then pow, pow, 2 shots right on top of each other. Well, right then I knew, wait a minute, you just can't do that with one person and a bolt-action rifle. But back then, Doug, we were all much more naive. We trusted the government. We believed in the government. We had all just come off of World War II. We thought, you know, we were God's gift to the world. We stood for freedom and democracy. And so I couldn't believe that, you know, it didn't settle with me, but I really didn't have anything to put in its place. But I began to keep up with the evidence. Now, we could spend this whole program on the Kennedy assassination, so I want to try to close this off, but I want to hit 2 or 3 little bits of evidence that you and your audience may or may not know that I think is very, very relevant. First off, on the Monday night after the Friday assassination, the district attorney of Dallas, Henry Wade, was holding a news conference, and he kind of blurted out, he said, oh, have I mentioned we have his fingerprints on the rifle? Lee Harvey Oswald. We've got his fingerprints on the rifle. Well, that pretty well cinched it in everybody's mind. You know, got to be guilty. Mm-hmm. His fingerprints are on the rifle. But now let's look closer. The very night of the assassination, against Texas law, against any common sense, there was pressure from Washington on the Dallas police to turn over all the evidence they were collecting to the FBI, and they had it shipped to Washington. Chief Curry said, well, how can we conduct an investigation if you're taking away all our evidence? He said, but finally they were pressured by people in Washington, and they caved in, and they sent all the evidence to Washington, D.C. The next day, on Saturday, the 23rd, I have a copy of the document signed by J. Edgar Hoover himself that states no usable fingerprints were found on the rifle or even the inner parts of the rifle. On Sunday morning, we have the transmission slips showing the rifle was sent back to Dallas. On Monday morning, 2 FBI agents, Harrison and Vincent Drain, carried the rifle to Miller Funeral Home in Fort Worth, where they were preparing Oswald's body for burial. Paul Grudy, G-R-O-O-D-Y, was the funeral home director and had, in a few years, had become a very good friend of mine because as a police reporter for the 4-Star Telegram, he was running the ambulance service. So anytime there's a wreck, an accident, plane crash, shooting, you know, and an ambulance is involved, then, you know, there I am trying to cover the story, and I'd end up talking to Paul Grudy. And he was a fine gentleman, a honest and really great guy. And he told me that he was there when the FBI agents put Oswald's dead hand on the rifle. And he said that, in fact, he had trouble getting the black fingerprint ink off of Oswald's dead hand in time for the burial that afternoon. So, as you can see, the evidence was fabricated. Now, that's number one. Number two, we have autopsy x-rays and photographs now that seem to indicate that he was shot from behind, as the official story says, blah, blah, blah. The fact is that Gerald Custer is the man. He's not a writer. He's not a conspiracy theorist. He is the man who took the x-rays of President Kennedy's head, along with Floyd Reby, who was the photographer at Bethesda Naval Hospital, who took the autopsy photographs, which are now being shown to us in the National Archives. Gerald Custer said there was no damage to his face or the part of the skull that is shown in the x-rays in the National Archives today, and he said, quote, "These are fake x-rays," end quote. A very respected doctor, Dr. David Mantic, has examined those x-rays and also concluded that they have been fabricated. All right? Floyd Reby, the photographer who took the photographs of Kennedy's body during the autopsy, said, quote, "The ones in the National Archives today are phony and not the photographs we took." Okay?
Wow.
So, now, again, to show the cover-up that has taken place, I interviewed the surveyors who had surveyed Dealey Plaza first for Life magazine. They were hired. Bob West was the county surveyor of Dallas County, and his friend and associate, Chester Brenneman. And they were hired on the Monday following the Friday assassination to survey Dealey Plaza. And they said that they were using still frames from the famous Zapruder film as comparison. So they were taking longitude, latitude, trajectories, elevations, etc. All right. And they said that Monday they and the Secret Service people they were working with all concluded amongst themselves that there was absolutely no way that one man could have done all this shooting. But then later in the spring of 1964, Chester Brenneman and West were hired again to survey Dealey Plaza, this time by the Warren Commission, the official federal investigation. Now, some years later, I interviewed Chester Brenneman, who had become county surveyor of Eastland County, and I also interviewed Bob West. And both of them said the Warren Commission altered their numbers. Now, the significance of this is very, very simple, but very, very critical. Today, we are beginning to see these programs and documentaries that purport to be computer simulations of the Kennedy assassination. And they say, oh, look, see, it's entirely possible for one man to have shot, one shot that caused seven wounds to two men and emerged unscathed. Of course, that's possible. See, look, we can do this by computer analysis. Well, as we all know, garbage in, garbage out in a computer.
That's right.
A computer only knows what you put into it. And obviously, they are using the government's figures and numbers, survey numbers, elevation numbers, you know, that they got from the Warren Commission, that the Warren Commission got from West and Brenneman. And both West and Brenneman told me the government altered the numbers. So what I'm telling you, Doug, and I'm telling your audience, you cannot believe any computer simulation today in the Kennedy assassination if it's based on the government numbers.
Interesting. But yet, you know, the millennials or the people, the young people who have grown up with computer games and familiar with the computer will turn to that, you know, and rely on that and believe that the simulation.
That's
just
it.
As they believe. Yeah, exactly. You know,
if they come on TV and say, here's a computer simulation, it shows 2 + 2 = 6, they'll believe it.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Yep. We are, you know, we are in trouble. I really appreciate, Jim, your time spent on this because, and I want to thank my daughter Jackie, who is here, handed me a receipt from Amazon. So it looks like she bought, Jim, you're off the hook. She went to Amazon and, bought me my own copy of Crossfire. So I can't
Crossfire.
Wait to
get that. Great. Yeah. Okay. So. Quickly then, in Crossfire, you will see the original Bob West Brenneman survey of Dealey Plaza, and you will see that they're marking bullet strikes on the curb. They're marking the yellow stripes where they set off the where the headshot took place, and yeah. These are sniper markings. And you'll also see where they said that the first shot is impossible to be come from the 6-4 depository because there was a tree intervening in the line of sight. And before we leave it, one other quick thing. Too many people have heard that, well, the driver turned and shot Kennedy, you know, which is that, no. That did not happen. And in the new edition of Crossfire, the one you're getting, you will find a close-up of the Zapruder film where you can clearly see that Greer, the driver's, his hands at all times are on the steering wheel. But it does not entirely absolve the Secret Service, because Greer also testified that he never looked around, he never looked back at Kennedy, that he was simply driving along, and the first thing he knew was when Kellerman next to him said, "We're hit, get us out of here." And that's when he stepped on the gas, and they sped out of Dealey Plaza. But the films, the Zapruder film, the Nix film, other films, and show a different story. They show that at the sound of the first shots, in contrary to Secret Service regulations, which state at the first sign of trouble, you get the gas, you hit the gas, and you get out of there. At the first shots, he hits the brakes. The car slows down to almost a complete stop, and Greer looks over his right shoulder towards Kennedy, and only after the fatal headshot is delivered does he look forward, the brake lights come off, and the car speeds out of Dealey Plaza.
Well, you know, Jim, this past spring, myself, my son Joe, Eric the Tech, Jackie, we were at Dealey Plaza. That was the first time I was ever there, and I was just surprised at the...
It's much smaller than you thought it was, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it is. And what really struck me being there and I was the fact that who would plan such a route? You know,
right.
the turns and such. It just struck me as really being odd that they would put Kennedy in that killing zone. Because
that's exactly what happened. Since you were there, you'll understand what I'm saying. Main Street comes straight down through Dealey Plaza, which, by the way, is kind of a triangle. It's a
right.
Pyramid, an inverted pyramid. And Main Street comes right down and bisects it and goes straight on under the underpass. Now, it is true. You can't argue that they changed the motorcade route, because it is true that certainly at that time, if you come down Main Street and you're trying to get to the Stemmons Expressway, you had to make a sharp right turn on Houston Street, and you make a 120-degree turn back onto Elm, which takes you through the right side of the north side of the Triple Underpass, where you exit the ramp to get onto Stemmons Expressway. Okay, but this is the President of the United States. They had closed off the streets. They had stopped traffic, you know. And if I'd been in charge of security, you could have put a 2x4 on Main Street there under the underpass. The car could have gone straight down through Dealey Plaza, rolled onto Elm over this very low curb, and then right on up onto Stemmons, and you would not have had to make that 120-degree turn in front of the school book depository, which, by the way, was a violation of Secret Service regulations, because I read it myself. They said you do not make any turns greater than 90 degrees, and if you have to make a 90-degree turn, you station security people there. Well, neither one of those were done.
Wow. Well, I'm excited, folks. We're talking with Jim Marrs, jimmarrs.com. That's M-A-R-R-S. Just a prolific author. And, of course, we're talking about the Kennedy assassination at this point. We've been talking about that here the past segment. Crossfire is the book. It's I was looking at it. And look at the editorial reviews on Amazon from Publishers Weekly, Library Journal, all positive. I can't wait to dig into the 648 pages in the newly revised and updated edition, Crossfire, if you are interested in what I believe is one of the most significant acts of, significant events, at least in my lifetime. That doesn't include, of course, 9/11. But so we've got so much to talk about, Jim. We've got about 3 minutes before we have to pause for the top of the hour. But
let me give you a teaser. Moving on from the Kennedy assassination and with the success, and by the way, it was only a couple of months after publication of Crossfire that I was contacted by Oliver Stone, who said, I'm making a movie, can I use your book? And I said, well, let me think about it. Okay. Sure. So it became a basis for the Oliver Stone film JFK that caused so much controversy at the time back in the early 90s. But as I would go around and ask people around the country, everything from boardrooms to cab drivers, what do you think's the next big, deep, dark, secret government cover-up? And, Doug, the answer was almost unanimous. People wanted to know about what is the truth about UFOs. Is there really anything there? And if there is, what is it? Is it us? Is it secret test craft? Or is it aliens? You know, what is it? And I thought, you know, I'd like to know, too. So that led to my next big bestseller, Alien Agenda, which, because it was about UFOs and it came out in the 90s, and most people were not ready to deal with that. It did not hit the New York Times bestseller list, but I have been told, since it's been translated into more than a dozen languages, it has become the top-selling nonfiction book on UFOs in the world.
Wow. And you've got a style. Well, you're an investigative journalist. I mean, your style of writing, and folks, Jim Marrs's books, and I'm not even going to say, forgive me for saying this, but your style of writing is just it's a pleasure to read. You laid the facts out. As a matter of fact, our occulted history, which we're going to get into next segment here, really, you lay the, and that was a wonderful segue, by the way, into that book, but your work is a pleasure to read. The investigative.
Well, thank you. Again, I think that comes back to two things. Number one, my journalism training. In English and in journalism, and after a number of years, you want to try to write plain. You want to try it straightforward to people. The other thing, of course, is I don't claim to be the world's greatest expert on anything, but I'm not stupid, and I'm a good old boy from Texas, and I try to just tell people, here's what it is, okay? But I also back it up with quotes and with statistics and with scientific papers and with the evidence, okay?
In fact, Doug,
you probably discovered this for yourself. When you go and try to tell somebody about some subject, you basically have two ways to go. You can either background them and start telling them the history. Let's say if you want to talk about some aspect of the Bible, you have to go back to Genesis, and you have to go back to the Old Testament, and you have to explain to them how this came, who wrote it, how they wrote it, how it changed over the years. And at that point, most of them have gone to sleep, right? And you've lost.
Exactly.
Them.
Stand
or
by,
you can
Jim.
Say, okay,
Jim.
Here it is. It is, and give it to them in 25 words or less. In which case, they say, "Well, I get it, but how do you know that? How can you
exactly.
prove that?"
and therein lies the rub. Jim, we're up against a hard break. Hold on, going to be right back. Jim Marrs is our guest. What a wonderful interview. Stay right with us.